Hi, so I'm Ethan Romero-Severson. I'm from the Theoretical Biology Group at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And you might wonder what I'm doing here. So I am here for my own self-interest because as a theorist, I believe that when theory becomes untethered to practice, it gets esoteric and essentially pointless. So I want to develop theoretical methods that are as close to practice as we can possibly make them. And in my mind, I see theory and practice relating in three fundamental ways. The first way is advocacy, and this is of the frame of the mindset where we would say, for example, if we implemented universal test and treat in South Africa, we would get some 50% reduction in incidence, and that's good. What theory is doing here is it's codifying our argument into something that's very precise. So it's no longer just an assertion, but it's now a rational argument based on assumptions. Second, we have science, the science mode, and this is to theory explains data, where we imagine that theory is a set of causal mechanisms that are actually generating data. And finally, the thing I want to talk about here is decision support. I think this is the most underserved relationship between theory and practice. And the point here is to answer the question, not what is the very best thing to do, it is what is the best thing that we can do given that we have limited resources, that we're highly constrained, and we can't act in a perfect rational way. So all the results that I'm talking about here are based on a set of numerical methods that we developed. I'm not going to go into any of this. I have no equations, so don't worry about that. But there was really a theoretical, the theory was lacking here, and we've kind of improved that scenario. So now you can do these analyses. So a good decision support framework should take the perspective of an actual institution, including its goals and limitations, and it should permit actual constraints, money, the cultural mores of the population, the institutional dexterity, and it should account for the nonlinear effects of the intervention itself, meaning that current interventions change the effectiveness of future interventions, and it should output programmatic benchmarks. So our approach is to formalize assumptions about sexual behavior, transmission, and the interventions themselves as a mathematical model, constrain that as much as possible, and we apply our algorithms to find what we call dynamic optimal control policies. And that's just a really fancy way of saying the best mixture of interventions for each year, and we allow that to change between years. So that's what I mean when I say dynamic. And then we assess the qualitative robustness of these dynamic optimal control policies, and I'll define that in a second here. So just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about when I talk about a dynamic optimal control policy, if you look at the figure on the right, this is an example where we're talking about the annual number of people enrolled into a PrEP program in red and a treatment as prevention program in blue. So in this particular situation, we enroll more people in PrEP. Oh, I'm sorry, on the x-axis we have years. So we're talking about a 50-year horizon here. So the optimal number of people to enroll, given that we have a limited budget, changes from year to year. So this is what I mean. This is the kind of output that I'm talking about. So here's the motivating question. I'm going to imagine that we are a non-governmental organization with a fixed annual budget. Our goal is to reduce HIV incidence as much as possible, and we're willing to invest in enrolling people into TAP or PrEP. And that we pay for finding, enrolling, and we pay for the first year of treatment or prophylaxis. The constraint is that we can only spend $3 million per year. And I also constrain this model, I'm not going to go into the details here, but I constrain it to kind of represent an average, large North American MSM population. I'm going to assume that all persons in the population attend a venue where a potential intervention occurs, meaning there's nobody that's unreachable in this population, and that treatment and prophylaxis are 100% effective. And it's important to note here that all these assumptions are negotiable. This is just what I've chosen because I needed to do something. So we can negotiate all of this. I'm not going to go into too many details about the model here, the mathematical model, but there's two important things to note. I'm a big advocate for this concept of episodic risk, that a lot of HIV risk is actually mediated through short periods of elevated risk behavior that may actually be uncharacteristic. So in this model, I have a high-risk population and a low-risk population, and people move between these populations. So I can be a low-risk person for a very long period of time and have this brief little bit. I break up with somebody, I maybe try some new drugs, or I do whatever. And I'm at elevated risk for a short period of time. So what I talk about when I'm talking about controls and control theory, when I'm representing this as a mathematical model, TAP, treatment as prevention, is moving chronically infected people into virally suppressed category where they're treated. They don't transmit in this category. That's what I mean. In the terms of this model, that's what TAP is doing. PrEP is doing the same thing, but for high-risk susceptible people. It's moving them into this protected category, where I assume they cannot get infected. I'm going to assume that only high-risk people, high-risk susceptibles, are on PrEP, and that once they move to low-risk, they go off of PrEP. The study design here is to fix parameters according to correspond to MSM in a large general North American city. We'll consider two levels of PrEP coverage, one where the institution pays for just 1 year of PrEP, and one where we assume that there's some other organization, like an insurance company, which is paying for as much PrEP as the person wants. We're going to calculate dynamic optimal control policies under alternative parameterizations in different dimensions. So we're going to look at the effect of having a different budget, the duration of high-risk behavior, the prevalence, the baseline level of viral suppression. I'm not going to show all of this because that's way too much stuff, but I'm only going to show a few things. So, for example, because I think episodic risk is really important, I'm looking at here dynamic optimal control policy for this hypothetical city or this hypothetical institution, where on the left you have a very short period of high risk, only 6 months, followed by a longer period of low risk. In the middle you have a period that's about 2 years, followed by a longer low risk period. And on the right you have lifetime high risk. So everyone that's high risk is always high risk, and everyone that's low risk is always low risk. On the top, you have 1 year of PrEP, and on the bottom, you have unlimited PrEP. There's a couple things to note here. So we have the three basic patterns of control that we see here. On the top, total investment in treatment as prevention. That turns out to be the best way to reduce incidence in this population. And an interesting thing is we see that this is totally independent of the sexual risk behaviors in this population. This is a robust dynamic control policy. That's what I mean. So if we have this basic policy holds, if there's only 1 year of PrEP. Now, if we move down into unlimited PrEP, we get some really complicated behavior. For example, we see that in two of the scenarios, PrEP is kind of the dominant control. And we see this kind of switching from no investment to PrEP to total PrEP, and this kind of coexistence of PrEP and TAP. To show you the efficacy that we get under these different scenarios, I'm plotting here the annual incidence in this hypothetical population. The blue line represents an only TAP strategy, a red line represents an only PrEP strategy, and a black line represents the optimum strategy, the very best, the mixture of the two. There's a couple things to note here. When we have only a year of PrEP, the efficacy of a PrEP intervention is extremely limited, actually, and we get almost no population-level effect at varying levels of risk behavior. And that's partly due to the fact that we simply cannot enroll enough people on PrEP to get a large population effect. Essentially, PrEP is like a time-limited vaccine, and if we can't vaccinate enough of the population, the effect is really limited. But we always get a good investment in treatment as prevention, although that investment slowly decays over time because it becomes more and more expensive to enroll people. However, we do see in the lifetime unlimited PrEP case that there are situations where PrEP is extremely efficacious, but it's kind of an all or nothing proposition. If we can get a large enough proportion of the population, we get a really massive effect. But if we get less than that proportion, we get a really limited effect. So this is a really key theoretical quantity when we want to translate PrEP practices in the field to public health impact. And we're kind of working on figuring out this from a theoretical perspective presently. One interesting point here is that In addition to the transmission dynamics, simply the amount of money that you want to spend affects the control, the optimality of the control. If you spend $1 million per year, put it all into TAP. If you spend $5 million per year, you get this really complicated mixture of TAP and PREP. So this is kind of a key point. I mean, the policy itself depends on how much money you're willing to invest in the policy. I think I'll skip over that. And finally, the final theoretical point I want to make is that there's really no single figure of merit when we talk about the effectiveness of an intervention. Like when we see that, you know, it costs X amount of dollars to prevent an infection by PrEP and Y amount of dollars to prevent an infection by treatment or whatever. Excuse me. Not only is this dependent on the population that we are looking at, this is also dependent on the past history of intervention in that population. So on the left here, I have the cost per enrolled case. And on the right, I have the cost per case averted. And we see that as we enroll people onto treatment as prevention, it becomes increasingly expensive because we enroll more people. They become harder and harder to find. In this particular case, PrEP doesn't get more expensive because in this instance, it's not particularly effective. So it costs about the same amount to enroll high-risk susceptibles because there's always about the same amount of high-risk susceptibles. All right. So finally, to summarize, my point here is that PrEP can be very efficient, but only really when there's a large proportion of the population are enrolled onto PrEP. And figuring out that exact number is something we're working on. High levels of PrEP can be obtained through increased budgets or just spending more money, or increasing the duration of PrEP by having it covered by insurance or some external organization. The optimal control policy can include long-term investment in both TAP and PrEP strategies. This is more of a technical point. This is surprising for mathematical reasons I won't get into, but it's interesting. And some of these patterns of control show robustness to realistic violation of some model assumptions. And I think this is really important because we don't want the model to be the truth. We're not arguing that the model is the end-all, be-all truth. The model is a way for us to understand, based on our assumptions, what we think should happen, and to evaluate that, what actually does happen, based on the model. So, and finally, the economics of intervention depend on population and sexual dynamics, but also on the past history of intervention. The framework that I presented here is extremely general. It can be applied to any scenario where you can write down a mathematical model, or at least somebody can, and you have different interventions you want to analyze. So this is the small team of people that have worked on this. There's myself at Los Alamos National Laboratory, Dmitry Gromov at St. Petersburg State University, Inga Bula at University of Greifswald, Awana Serra at University of Papillon, and Ian Spicknell here at the Division of STD Prevention at the CDC. That's all.